sidelines, Iran calls on JCPOA participants and the U.S. to prove their genuine intention in the Vienna talks by returning to full compliance and removing all illegal sanctions. China warns the U.S. against having any illusions about Taiwan, saying, quote, there's no room for compromise over the territory. And also, tragedy in Russia. 11 people are killed and dozens trapped in a Siberia mine incident. Welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to hold talks in Vienna next week. Now, Iran says the negotiations are a chance for the U.S. and the remaining signatories to prove their genuine intention. To fulfill that, the other side should get back to full implementation of their commitments through lifting all inhuman and illegal sanctions in an effective manner. That's according to the acting head of Iran mission in Vienna, Mohammad Reza. Ghaibi, who made those comments in a statement to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Ghaibi said the sole cause of the current problems regarding the nuclear deal is the 2018 U.S. withdrawal and reimposition of sanctions. He criticized Europe for failing to acknowledge that. Ghaibi defended Iran's remedial actions, saying they are within the framework of the nuclear agreement. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman rejects Bahraini accusations linking his country to a bomb attack Manama says was recently foiled. Said Khatibzadeh calls the allegations baseless, saying they show Bahrain's lack of comprehension about regional issues. He once again criticizes Bahrain for establishing ties with what he calls the illegitimate Israeli regime. The Iranian official says Bahrain puts those ties above relations with its own people while refusing to fulfill their righteous civil demands. Khatibzadeh also says the Manama regime cannot cover up its problems at home and abroad by leveling such false accusations against Iran. On Monday, Bahrain said it had arrested a number of Iran-linked suspects and confiscated weapons and explosives ahead of, quote, a planned terrorist attack. Outrage against the UK decision to declare Hamas a terrorist organization keeps pouring in. Now representatives of Palestinian resistance groups in Tehran have called on the international community to take serious measures against London's decision. Salman Khoudry reports from the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Representatives of Palestinian resistance groups in Tehran have held a press conference to elaborate on the goals behind the UK decision to declare Hamas as a terrorist organization. Representative of Hamas in Tehran, Khaled Al-Qadoumi, said the recent decision by Britain is politically motivated. He further said the UK has always supported the Zionist regime, and Britain and global arrogance are to be blamed for all the crimes and brutalities against the Palestinians.
When they have themselves commented on this announcement, and this condemned announcement, they said that Hamas has to engage politically. So it tells you directly that this is a political decision. It has nothing to do with the Hamas ideology or Hamas behavior. Hence, we in Palestine reject and straightforward condemn this resolution. We do not accept it. This does not represent the actual and real crux of the human notion and democracy. We are an elected, a democratically elected movement. We are representing our own people, and the whole Palestinian arena in Foreign Ministry of Palestine, ambassadors of Palestinian authorities, Palestinian factions, they have condemned this resolution.
Meanwhile, representative of Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement in Tehran called on the international community to take more serious action in condemnation of the UK decision against Hamas.
We urge the international community to take a serious action against the recent UK decision to declare Hamas as a terrorist organization. Resistance is the legitimate right of Palestinians to defend themselves. We call on all freedom seekers around the world to stand against such a move by global arrogance.
Recently, the British Home Secretary announced that she was seeking to declare the whole of Islamic resistance movement, Hamas, a terrorist organization. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian condemned Britain's move, saying the rights of Palestinians cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. In a statement, Hamas responded by asserting that instead of apologizing and correcting its historical sin against the Palestinian people, Britain supports the aggressors at the expense of the victims.
Palestinian groups believe that the recent UK decision is an unfortunate continuation of London's bias in favor of the Israeli regime and its policies, which are based on terror, massacre, and destruction. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
China issues a new warning to the U.S. over Taiwan, stressing that the island remains an especial issue for Beijing. Tensions have in recent months flared up between the two powers over the island amid U.S. military support for Taiwan. We discuss that in our news review program. Let's see what our guests have to say. China renewing warnings to the United States over Taiwan. Beijing says it has no room for compromise over the island, and Washington should not have any illusions about this. The Chinese Defense Ministry spokesman says the country is willing to maintain with the U.S., but he adds the American side for a period of time has said a lot of what he calls irresponsible and provocative things on Taiwan. Wu Chan says Taiwan is opposed to the violation of its sovereignty and core interests, adding the Taiwan issue is a special one for Beijing. That's because China views the island as its own territory, but the U.S. government has been irking Beijing by forging ties with Taipei through arms sales and official interactions. Beijing believes the U.S. Measures embolden Taiwan in its push for independence from China. Joining us now on this edition of the News Review, we have Senior Fellow at the Pangol Institution, Kin Do-Ju, and also we have International and Independent China Strategist, Andrew K.P. Loy, joining us from Hong Kong. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with our guest in Beijing, Mr. Zhu. Let's talk about the issue at hand right now as China is renewing warnings to the United States over Taiwan. Beijing says that it has no room for compromise over the island. Tell us, how serious are the tensions right now?
The U.S., since actually the Trump government and now Biden continuing this policy, basically to contain China, to keep China down. You know, one thing they can do to destabilize the Chinese development, for example, is really the Taiwan card. They can play up with this Taiwan issue by giving Taiwan more international exposure, by upgrading their relationship with Taiwan, by encouraging Lithuania to challenge the One China principle, for example. So when the Chinese spokesperson said there's no room for China to step back, is to compromise, that's true because it's an issue of sovereignty, it's an issue of territorial integrity. So for China, I think the U.S. behavior, they got to be careful, otherwise they are basically forcing China to take tough measures against Taiwan, or probably somehow, moving forward about their schedule of national reunification to bring Taiwan back, to bring Taiwan under full control of the central government. In that case, that would be a disaster for this region, for this relationship between China and the U.S. And the U.S. should be held accountable for the consequence.
Andrew K.P. Long in Hong Kong, China has said that it's willing to maintain cooperation with Washington, in the words of the Chinese Defense Ministry. However, the American side for a period of time has said a lot of what he calls irresponsible and provocative things on the issue of Taiwan. What is the U.S. trying to achieve at this point?
Well, of course, the United States is trying to use ideology as another weapon against China by, for example, by organizing so-called a global forum for democracy, inviting Taiwan to participate amongst other countries less friendly to China. But what the United States is trying to achieve is to push the envelope as far as possible while paying lip service to the so-called One China policy, because to the United States, Taiwan is an unsinkable aircraft carrier against China. But I think that also the United States seems to be emboldened by recent military assessments. For example, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, recently testified that China is not yet ready or capable or fully confident of recovering Taiwan, bearing in mind that amphibious invasion is the most difficult mission in wartime, in war history, throughout history, especially across the Taiwan Strait. But I think that this underestimates China's recent military advancements, for example, including hypersonic weaponry and also anti-access area denial capabilities with aircraft killing missiles. So I think that this is a very dangerous game. Whereas the United States sector is open to cooperation with China, it's limited, trying to limit the space as far as possible, almost entirely only to climate change. But for the rest of the areas, we're trying to push the using a strategy of maximum confrontation on all fronts, on trade, technology, as I said, South China Sea, diplomacy, ideology. Because the American fears that this opposition is the world hegemon or the so-called leader of the so-called liberal world is now being threatened because of various internal incapacities or conflicts and its inability to extend power across the globe is declining, as exemplified by its recent retreat from Afghanistan. So I think that this is a reaction, and this anti-China policy 360-degree pushback is bipartisan. So I think that this we've seen this conflict is likely to continue. But the danger is that this this could easily lead to a hot war over the Taiwan Strait, because both powers are not only nuclear powers, but armed with intercontinental missiles or hypersonic weapons, and it's a very dangerous game.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Senior fellow at Pangol Institution, Kim Dozhu, joining us from Beijing, and thanks to international independent China strategist Andrew K.P. Loing, speaking to us from Hong Kong. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Welcome back. The death toll from a fire accident in a coal mine in Siberia has risen to 11. Dozens of others are injured, while nearly 50 remain trapped. Russian officials say so far attempts to communicate with them have been unsuccessful. The rescue operation has been temporarily stopped amid fears of a potential explosion. According to local officials, more than 200 workers have been taken to the surface. Some are suffering from poisoning. The blaze was reportedly started after coal dust caught fire in a ventilation shaft. Mine accidents are relatively common in Siberia, with poor safety standards and aging equipment being blamed. A senior Belarusian security official defends his country's stance on the ongoing migrant crisis at the border with Poland. Alexander Wolfovich says Belarus is not responsible for what's happening there. Wolfovich says, or rather, who heads Belarus's Security Council, also rejects allegations that the country facilitates illegal migration to the European Union. He says this year alone, Belarus has detained over 11,500 illegal migrants and deported nearly 5,000. Thousands of migrants, mainly from the Middle East, have been trying to get into the European Union via Belarus while facing tough conditions. Western countries accuse Belarus and Russia of orchestrating the crisis. The two, however, reject the accusation and instead blame the other side. Jerome Hughes in Brussels says the European Union is making no effort to help Belarus in the ongoing migrant crisis at its border with Poland.
The European Union is attracting a lot of criticism from organizations like Human Rights Watch in relation to its handling of this situation, because when you mention the figures there, it's very difficult for the Belarusian authorities to try and tackle this issue themselves and to try and determine the status of these individuals, these migrants, because as you say, there are so many of them. And when in particular, I mean, the point has been made, when you have hundreds and when you have thousands of these people approaching EU borders, the EU, because of the Belarusian authorities having such a big challenge with this issue, the EU does have a responsibility to try and determine the status of these people. you know, because we call them migrants, and of course in the main that is correct, but amongst those people there are genuine refugees, but the European Union is making no effort to assist the Belarusian authorities to try and determine who is a refugee, who is a migrant, who is an illegal immigrant, and so on.
Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, is rocked by yet another bomb blast, with at least 8 people losing their lives in the latest such attack. Nearly 24 are also injured as a bomb rips through the center of the city. Officials say the target was a United Nations convoy passing in the area. The explosion caused material damage to a nearby school and hospital. Gunfire is also reported after the blast. Somali officials blame the Al-Shabaab terror group for the violence. The group frequently conducts bomb attacks in Mogadishu as they continue fighting the central government. Al-Shabaab terrorists have been attempting to establish their own rule in Somalia for over a decade now. Anti-government protesters in the Solomon Islands defy a lockdown and take to the streets in the capital, Honiara, for a second day on Thursday. The protesters set several buildings on fire again. A host of domestic issues, including failed development promises, are said to be triggering the unrest. The demonstrators want Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare to step down. Sogavare, however, says the government is in control. On Wednesday, he called the rallies an unfortunate event aimed at bringing down a democratically elected government. He declared a 36-hour lockdown that would run until 7 p.m. on Thursday, GMT. There are also reactions from outside the country. China expresses concern about the unrest. Australia says it's sending peacekeeping forces to the Solomon Islands at the request of its government. Germany's COVID death toll has surpassed 100,000 as the country battles a fresh wave of rising infections. The death toll jumped on Thursday after the country reported 351 new daily fatalities. The rising infections are causing a health crisis, with intensive care units being filled up. Health officials say some hospitals are facing what they call an acute overload, making it necessary to transfer COVID patients abroad. Germany has already tightened restrictions. They include requiring people to prove they are vaccinated, cured, or have recently tested negative for COVID before they can travel on public transport or go into the workplace. The country is now considering a full lockdown and mandatory vaccines. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The unity of Muslims is a definite Quranic duty. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
The unity and solidarity of Muslims is not a tactic in the way, as some people now think, that we should be united because of certain circumstances. No, it is a matter of principle. The cooperation of Muslims is necessary. If Muslims are united, they will help each other and all will become strong. When this cooperation exists, even those who want to interact with non-Muslims, which is all right, will enter into this interaction with full hands. So the next point is that this is a fundamental matter, not a tactical one. The reason we in the Islamic Republic greatly emphasize the unity of Muslims is that there is a wide gap. Today, there is a constant, serious, premeditated effort to create differences between Muslim denominations and between Shia and Sunni. Today, the words Shia and Sunni have entered the American political discourse.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What do Americans have to do with Shia and Sunni? For several years now, in American political discourse, the issue of being a Sunni or being a Shia has been introduced. They identify some countries as Shia countries and some as Sunni countries. Despite the fact that they are against the essence of Islam and hostile towards it, they do not abandon the issue of Shia and Sunni. So, such issues exist. They are aggravating the discourse on a daily basis and increasing the misunderstandings. Therefore, we emphasize unity, and this is the reason. As you can see, the puppets installed by the US create discord in the world of Islam wherever they can. The closest example is the tragic, upsetting events in Afghanistan these last two Fridays, where they blew up a Muslim mosque while the people were praying.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets in major cities across the country on Monday to denounce the U.S. complicity in the protracted Saudi war on the Arab country. The biggest rally was held in the northwestern city of Sada, where thousands carrying Yemeni flags and chanting anti-American and anti-Saudi slogans poured into the streets. The protesters say Washington is behind a military and economic war on the nation and is prolonging the war and siege of Yemen. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, a senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, says the United States spearheads the devastating Saudi-led military aggression and brutal siege against his country, stating that Washington is complicit in the crimes that the Riyadh regime is committing against the Yemeni nation. He said the U.S. has been killing Yemeni people and destroying vital infrastructure for the past 7 years, stressing that the Riyadh regime and its regional allies would not have been able to do anything without Washington's support.
We saw in the last days only Saudi Arabia carried out in one day 65 attacks on different civilian targets in Yemen. This is how we see the Americans' complicity, because they do nothing to stop the Saudi war. On the contrary, they encourage this war to continue.
The organizers of the protest said in a statement that Washington was misleading the world about its stance toward Yemen. The statement said the administration of President Joe Biden continues to provide Riyadh and its regional allies with military and political support, enabling them to press ahead with their onslaught and commit crimes against the people of Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The U.S. president made the pledge back in February this year. He touted the move as part of efforts to restore an emphasis on human rights. Biden, however, said Washington will continue to support and help Riyadh. The peace activists who hailed his announcement are now dismayed at his administration for going back on the promise. Back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. A State Department spokesperson defended the sale as, quote, fully consistent with the administration's pledge to lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen.
We see that there is no will to end this war on Yemen. Moreover, we see also the Americans are not asking the Saudis to lift the siege on the Yemeni harbor and the Yemeni airport in Sana'a. Therefore, they are the direct contributor of the siege imposed on the population of Yemen.
President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he's taken much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States. The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. Wouldn't that embolden those officials to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in the most literal sense?
The Genoa U.S. Indian Industrial School, a government-run boarding school for Native Americans located on the edge of town in Genoa, Nebraska. Decades after its closure in 1934, researchers have unearthed the bleak history of this institution. They confirmed that over 100 Native American children died at this school, using newspaper archives and school newsletters to identify them, because official records were destroyed when the school closed. Search for the graves of children is in progress at the site of the Genoa school. Researchers said the true death toll is probably much higher. The past passing of the Civilization Fund Act in 1819 by the U.S. Congress authorized the government to establish residential boarding schools and relocate Native American children by force. It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of children were sent to boarding schools operated by the government or churches across the U.S. However, some never returned home. Students were victims of harsh punishments and hard labor, and many of them died of diseases. One descendant claimed his great-grandmother was blinded while a student at Genoa, probably by having lye soap rubbed into her eyes as punishment. While they were removed from their families and homeland, children were prohibited from speaking tribal languages in a bid to subdue or eliminate the Native American culture. The narrative has an uncanny resemblance to Canada's residential school system. In the 19th century, Canada also established mandatory boarding schools for Indigenous children. 150,000 Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against children. This year, remains of 215 First Nation children were discovered at the site of a former residential school near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. Some of the children were as young as 3 years old. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded that the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners through the 20th century.
You just imagine this. Somebody coming to your home and taking your children from you when they're 5 years old, 4 years old, and taking them away, away from your influence, away from your understanding, away from your culture. That's what happens to Indigenous people in the United States and in Canada.
One of the tactics used by the U.S. federal government to destroy the culture, religion, and way of life of Native Americans was the establishment of boarding schools. The discovery in Genoa School is only a tiny part of the immense hardship colonial settlers inflicted on Native Americans. Back in the late 1700s, American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. When Christopher Columbus reached the Americas in 1492, 10 million indigenous people lived in what is now the United States. By 1900, there were less than 300,000. Another atrocity against Native people in America is the implementation of the Indian Removal Act. In 1830, the U.S. federal government endowed itself with the right to take Native-held land east of Mississippi and forcibly relocate Native people from their homes in Georgia, Alabama, North Carolina, Florida, and Tennessee to Indian territory in what is now Oklahoma. In a mass atrocity remembered as the Trail of Tears, tens of thousands of Native Americans died or were killed after fleeing their homes in terror.
The immigrants never had any land when they got here, and whatever they got in terms of land, they stole.
Native Americans were expelled from the lands they had lived in for generations. They were victims of wars, mass killings, and discriminations while the U.S. government destroyed their cultural traditions. Even today, discrimination and oppression against minorities exists in the U.S., as racial discrimination is systematic in American society. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is now designated as a terrorist organization by Britain following the Friday announcement of UK Home Secretary Priti Patel. The move brings Britain in line with the United States, which designated Hamas a terrorist group in 1995, and the European Union. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel justified the decision by arguing that it was not possible to distinguish Hamas's political and military wings. She claimed that Hamas has a significant terrorist capability and access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. This is while the group uses its weapons to defend the Gaza Strip against Israeli aggression. Patel also highlighted the importance of a ban to protect the Jewish community. The British official, however, did not make any reference to Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The British Parliament will vote on the proposals next week. If Patel's bid succeeds, showing support for Hamas in Britain could be punished with up to 14 years in prison. Israel applauded the news, with its foreign minister, Yair Lapid, saying the move was a result of joint efforts between the British and Israeli regimes.
And, of course, it was all in cahoots with Washington as well. Apparently, the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who announced this decision, made the announcement in Washington, not even in London. So you can see the Israelis, the British, and the Americans were all involved in this.
The London's decision adds the political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on the movement's military wing, Al-Qassam Brigades. This move has drawn widespread condemnation. The Palestinian Authority says the UK took the measures at Israel's request, adding that it's an unjustified aggression against the Palestinians and will hamper reconstruction efforts in the besieged Gaza Strip. Iran has also denounced the British measures. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. Hamas has slammed the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people.
The British Home Office's decision to consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
Hamas's spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians. The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the British government in 1917 during the First World War, which laid the foundations for the entity of Israel. The declaration is seen as a catalyst for the 1948 Nakba, where more than 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned the ban on Hamas, describing the move as an unjustified attack on Palestinians who have been subjected to the most heinous forms of occupation and historical injustice as a result of the Balfour Declaration. Following the blacklisting of Hamas, the resistance movement reacted, saying in a statement that, instead of apologizing and correcting its historical sin against the Palestinian people, Britain supports the aggressors at the expense of the victims. It also added, resisting occupation by all available means, including armed resistance, is a right guaranteed by international law to people under occupation. Hamas also urged its supporters to condemn the UK's move, as it described Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands, forcible displacement of Palestinians, the demolition of their homes, and the siege of more than 2 million people in the Gaza Strip as terrorism.
Well, implicitly, I guess it's saying okay to Israeli crimes, but no different from they've been saying okay to Israeli crimes since 1917. So in that sense, it's nothing new.
Based in Gaza, Hamas is a resistance group against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Hamas and Israel clashed most recently in a deadly asymmetrical war in May, during which the Israeli regime killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, through its continuous bombardment of the Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days.
cost of living in the UK surged in October to a 10-year high, with the figure now more than double the target set by the Bank of England. The UK's Consumer Prices Index rose by 4.2% in the 12 months to October, up from 3.1% in September. Driven by a dramatic jump in household gas and electricity prices, the figure was higher than forecast by economists.
Now, there's a lot of different factors. The big one, of course, is the incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, which cut Britain off from its major sources of trade and raw materials, has made everything much more expensive. He's managed to introduce, they've reintroduced customs charges, they've reintroduced processing charges that didn't exist in a free market. So, of course, prices go up.
With the annual inflation rate more than double the 2% target set by the government for the Bank of England, the increase will put pressure on the bank to raise interest rates from as early as next month amid growing concern over the cost of living. Rising consumer prices have ramped up the cost of living, especially when wages have failed to keep pace. The Bank of England expects inflation to rise further to around 5% in the spring of 2022, before falling back towards its 2% target by late 2023.
Now, there are two aspects of all of this. Inflation is a question of the value of the currency. When the currency is devalued, you get inflation. But rising prices are a separate issue. Not all prices are rising. On the contrary, property and some things are going down.
As the impact of higher oil and gas prices fades and demand for goods moderates, household energy bills were the biggest driver of inflation after Ofgem, the energy regulator, lifted the price cap on domestic gas and electricity last month. It meant that gas bills rose by 28.1% in the year to October, while electricity climbed by 18.8%.
Most working people in the Western world have been on certainly in the Anglo-speaking world, have been on a petrol pay freeze since Ronald Reagan in 1975 in real terms. Their wages have been held down, while productivity and profits and the share that the bankers take has rocketed upwards.
Demand for oil and gas is pushing up energy prices worldwide. This means higher bills for householders and for businesses, many of whom will pass on some or all of the extra energy costs to their customers. UK authorities in October lifted the so-called energy price cap, which limits standard variable tariffs charged by domestic energy providers.
The effect is catastrophic. In Britain, the energy prices shot up, and the government's response was to cut back on the welfare spending, to cut back on the money that unemployed and ill people got. So they've deliberately targeted poorer people.
UK and European gas prices have hit one-month highs as concerns over winter energy supplies rise. Delays to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia have stoked fears of a winter natural gas shortage in Europe. Germany has suspended its approval process for the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which would double its reliance on Russian gas following growing geopolitical pressure to scrap the project. The suspension of the Nord Stream certification is a setback to Gazprom's plans to extend Russian gas dominance via a new pipeline across the Baltic Sea. Europe faces a looming winter gas crisis, which has fueled fears of a widespread industrial slowdown due to factory shutdowns and potential power outages. It is also expected to drive a cost of living crisis for homes and small businesses. Gas prices have reached record highs in recent months, ignited by the global surge in demand after the COVID-19 economic slowdown last year, and fueled by Russia's reluctance to export extra supplies to Europe to help meet demand, despite rocketing market prices.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, hated the people who were endowed with the following traits. He, peace be upon him, said, four traits lead to the quickest punishment. The person whom you treat with kindness, but he mistreats you. The person who you do not oppress, but oppresses you. The person to whom you are loyal, but he betrays you. The person who visits his relations, but they end their relationship with him.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has these beautiful conversations and these beautiful dialogues with his friends, his companions, his relatives, his family members, and, you know, the people in general. And so Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, he has this very beautiful way of putting forth wisdom in a very concise, precise, accurate, short, and beautiful manner. What is interesting is that this quality is not limited to just Imam al-Baqir, but all of the divinely appointed infallible imams had this quality within them, and of course, the master of us all, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, also had this quality. So in one of these conversations, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked about who are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. He is asked, what is an attribute of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Holy Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams? Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he replies that our followers are those who obey Allah. Unbelievable. And we say, Allahu Akbar. God is great. Allah is great. This sentence of maybe four or five words in reply to this question about the attributes and who are the followers of the Holy Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, our followers are those who obey Allah. So, dear friends, if we consider ourselves to be the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, if we consider ourselves to be the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, if we consider ourselves to be the supporters and the friends of the Ahlul Bayt, then we must obey Allah. And obeying Allah comes in two manners, in two forms, in two faces. One is to do all those things which Allah has made wajib, obligatory upon us. And the second is to refrain from anything and everything that Allah has made haram for us, forbidden for us. So, if you want to be a follower of the Holy Prophet and of the Ahlul Bayt, remember to obey Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. Unfortunately, we live at a bad time. That's the problem at the time of Imam al-Baqir, Imam Zain al-Abidin. People that had good attire, looked religious, had contact with a few of the tabi'een, they said the Prophet said this, everybody trusted that. Imam Zain al-Abidin, Imam al-Baqir, most of all. That's not how this works. We have to do that. And then lastly, but most importantly, and we keep saying this, and we will continue to keep saying this, because it is a must. The reason why Imam al-Baqir kept saying this in so many different ways. Brothers and sisters, the Qur'an is available to us. The Qur'an is available to us. Wallah, the Qur'an is available to us. The Qur'an is the word of God. No word in it has changed. No sentence in it has changed. We have access to this book today, and anything we hear of Islam can be referred back to the Quran, should be referred back to the Quran and seen, is it, does it match it? Does it not match it? The Imam did not tell scholars only. This was for a lot of different people. The Quran says this. The Quran didn't come for ulama. The Quran came for everyone. The Quran is available for everyone. God in it. Let's listen to what he says. He says, Hudan linnas, not Hudan lil ulama. It's guidance for all people. And it says, it's bayinat. It's got clarity in it. The pillars of clarity, and then what, based on those pillars, can be understood. There's muhkam and mutashabih. The Quran itself says not everything has that level of clarity on the subject. It's still clear, but to understand that, you need to understand something else, which is called muhkam in the Quran. But if you constantly refer to the Quran, if we are regularly in touch with the Quran, if we regularly read the Quran with understanding, try to reflect and understand it, and when we understand something, implement it. If we do that, Wallah, the book will speak to you. This is not my words. The Quran says it. Imam al-Baqir says it. The living Quran says it.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Rather newly established sheikhdom in the Persian Gulf, the United Arab Emirates is trying hard to gain its foothold in the region. This ambition has been accompanied with a series of military adventurism or acts of sabotage, the most recent and vicious one, Abu Dhabi's participation in the Yemen War, a bloody campaign spearheaded by the Saudis against the poorest nation in the region. But Yemen has been just an overt instance of the Emirati's destructive role in the region. The fact is the UAE hasn't missed a single chance, especially in recent years, to exert influence in countries plagued with internal crises. Above all, Iraq, a country of critical importance. Back in 2019, when widespread protests took the Iraqi authorities by surprise, Abu Dhabi was reportedly orchestrating a coup in Iraq. The prominent Iraqi politician, Izzat al-Shabandar, sounded the alarm that the UAE was backing seditious moves in the Iraqi protests and arming four tribal groups in Al-Anbar province to form a military force in order to separate the province.